If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 547, Population Narratives, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Thursday, June 27th, 2019. In this episode of the podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that took place as a live terrestrial radio conversation a couple of weeks ago. I have no good reason for waiting as long as I have to put it up as a podcast. But the conversation is with Bill Ryerson. He is the founder of Population Media Center, which is up in Burlington, Vermont, a couple hours from here. And I met Bill in Dallas, Texas, back in April at that Earth Day event that I went to. And while the name of his organization, Population Media Center and also Population Institute, give you an idea of what his focus is, he's also associated with the Post-Carbon Institute, something that longtime Sea Realm listeners will probably be familiar with. And in fact, the service that we use to archive our radio shows at WOOL sometimes is not quite in sync with, you know, the clock. And so the first few minutes of the conversation are lost, but I guess it's really just a couple of minutes. The recording picks up with me reading Bill Ryerson's Post-Carbon Institute bio.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
William Ryerson is founder and president of Population Media Center and president of the Population Institute. For over 40 years, he has worked in the field of reproductive health, including 2 decades of experience adapting the Sabido methodology for behavioral change communications to various cultural settings around the world. And we'll talk about that method because it's one that I intend to use in a comic strip, an ongoing weekly comic strip that I'm doing for Progressives for Immigration Reform. And it was Kevin Lynn, the director of that organization, who brought the method to my attention, and I'm pretty sure he got it from you.
Did.
So, Bill, you're calling from Vermont. Where are you in Vermont?
In Shelburne, Vermont.
I have never been to Shelburne, Vermont. Where is that in relation to, say, Burlington?
It's 9 miles south. It's a suburb of Burlington.
And the Population Media Center, which you are the president and founder of, is in South Burlington, Vermont. How old is that organization?
I started it 21 years ago yesterday, so it's just celebrated its 21st anniversary.
Well, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Wow. So 21 years. I checked just this morning. I was born in 1968, and the population has more than doubled in my lifetime, the global population. I imagine it's more than doubled in your lifetime.
Yes, much more than doubled. The easy way to think about population in terms of a place the size of Vermont, which is about 625,000 people, is that the world's population is growing by a new Vermont every 3 days.
Wow. You know, I live in southern Vermont, and population is not dense here. So it's my vision of Vermont is probably a bit different from yours in terms of population density.
Well, sure. Burlington area is the most populated part of the state.
I'd like to read something from the Population Media Center website, and I think this will introduce us to a good suite of topics. These are words I believe that you are the author of. So this is a message from PMC President Bill Ryerson. Addressing population through health and human rights enhancing methods improves the health and prosperity of families while simultaneously lessening the harmful impact of humanity on the Earth's environment. The human suffering from excessive childbearing is staggering and preventable. 600,000 women and girls die worldwide every year from pregnancy and childbirth, a figure equal to U.S. deaths in World War I, World War II, the Korean and Vietnam Wars combined. Most of these women are in their teens and early 20s, forced by their societies into bearing children at a young age and far too frequently. 140,000 women bleed to death each year during childbirth. Tragically, many die within reach of medical facilities because their relatives refuse to allow them to be treated by male doctors. 75,000 women die each year trying to end their pregnancies. The UN estimates that worldwide, 50,000 women and girls try to induce abortions on themselves each day, 18.3 million per year. Many of those who survive face lifelong disabling pain. Approximately 100,000 women die each year from infection, and another 40,000 women die from the agony of prolonged labor. And those are only the fatalities. UNICEF's statistics show that for every woman who dies, 30 survive with gruesome injuries and disabilities. That's more than 17 million women per year. So I think that's probably a sobering but also enlightening place to start our conversation. I'd like to invite you to talk about what happens in terms of population when you give women education and opportunities that their society had previously denied them.
Sure. When you think about the fact that women become fertile at around 12, 13, 14 years old, in very poor societies where these girls cannot afford sanitary pads, they often miss a week of school per month. And after a couple of years of that, they're so far behind in their studies, they often drop out and get married and start having children. And that's a particularly dangerous time to be delivering a baby, because the woman is not physically nor mentally mature enough to be a mother. And so there's a very high rate of infant mortality as well as maternal mortality and morbidity associated with that. When a girl is unable to stay in school, just, for example, through the provision of sanitary pads, it dramatically reduces early childbearing and reduces lifetime childbearing. It also produces a woman who becomes a much better educated and therefore more effective mother and is better able to care for her family. So just in terms of health, girls' education is critically important, and one can look globally at the statistics. For every additional year of secondary school, fertility rate drops dramatically. So girls' education is a key issue, and indeed getting men as well as women to recognize the importance of sending their daughters to school and not just prioritizing sons is one of our top goals, because often people in rural areas think that the girl's role is to fetch firewood and work in the kitchen with her mother until she's 15, and then they can sell her into marriage. And changing that norm is a huge challenge, but doable.
In pursuing the work that the Population Media Center does, you travel extensively. Where are some of the places that you have seen?
I've been to 92 countries, so we could spend the hour talking about the places I have seen. But, you know, a lot of our work outside of a Hollywood show that we can talk about has been in very poor countries. So Democratic Republic of the Congo, Nigeria, Burundi, Rwanda, Ethiopia, Sudan, and now we're just starting up programs in Uganda and Zambia. We've also worked in Asia, Papua New Guinea, Asia Pacific, Papua New Guinea, Nepal, India, Philippines, and in Latin America, Guatemala, Haiti, Mexico, Brazil. And the work we're doing in Mexico often gets exported around Spanish-speaking Latin America and even to the U.S. We've been involved in some telenovela projects in Mexico that have dealt with the issue of teen pregnancy and parenthood.
Well, we are speaking on live terrestrial radio. Most of the people who hear this conversation will hear it on as a podcast online somehow. But right now, the people in the Bellows Falls area and also Walpole, New Hampshire, are hearing it on live terrestrial radio, which is alive and well in many parts of the world. And your organization's efforts have focused largely on radio dramas. Would you talk about that?
Think about rural Ethiopia, where almost no one has television and electrical supplies are so uncertain that watching TV is a nuisance anyway. Radio is really the new medium. Maybe 6% of Ethiopians have TV, and those are urbanites. but radio is the dominant medium. And that's true in all of sub-Saharan Africa, with just a couple of exceptions. Radio is the dominant medium. So radio has many benefits, one of which is that you engage the mind of the listener in a way that television cannot, because they have to imagine how the characters appear and what's going on to some extent, whereas television spells it all out. So radio listeners are in many ways more engaged. Second, radio is one-fifth the cost of television. And so in terms of reaching people, the cost per listener and the cost per behavior change, which we can actually measure, is much lower than TV shows. So it's really a magical time in much of Africa where there are government broadcasters who reach the majority of the population. We can, in some countries like Sierra Leone and northern Nigeria, pull in over half the population of the country as regular listeners to our show. For example, in northern Nigeria, we did a show across four northern states, Kano, Kaduna, Katsina, and Sokoto states. And the survey at the end of listeners, or of the population, I should say, it was a random sample survey, showed 71% reported listening at least weekly to a show that had been on the air twice a week. In Sierra Leone, 50% reported listening at least weekly. In Ethiopia, 46% reported listening at least weekly. So these are huge audiences compared to what one can get in a developed country with a lot of television stations. And so we're able to affect change across the entire society with these radio dramas. And because the cost is lower, we're able to do 150 or 200 episodes in a serialized drama using the method you mentioned, created by Miguel Sabido of Mexico, that has key middle-of-the-road characters designed to represent segments of the audience and to be aspirational for them, but very similar to them. And those characters sort out conflicting advice from the positive and negative characters one finds in all melodrama. And over the 150 or 200 episodes, they gradually evolve into positive role models for the audience. And they show the audience the benefits of the new behavior, and they deal with the pushback that one gets when somebody tries something unusual or innovative in any society. And so they show the audience how to deal with that pushback. And they ultimately become very outspoken advocates for the new behavior among other characters, thus role modeling advocacy for the audience. And we're able to actually measure changes among our audience members in self-reported interpersonal communication about the issues we're addressing, whether it's violence against women, girls' education, stopping child marriage, or use of family planning.
How much of the message that you're looking to impart with these radio dramas is sort of standard that you use everywhere you go, and how much would be very specific to the needs of the local population?
I would say most of it is based on the needs of the local population. So we don't set out with a particular storyline in any country. We create it afresh. And we do this based on two key issues. One is, what are the policies of that country? So being in South Burlington, Vermont, we're not going into Ethiopia and saying, here's how your people should live. We're saying, what are the policies of Ethiopia? And we take those policies, except any policies that counter UN agreements or human rights accords, and we use those as the basis for the values of the show. And then we do formative research, very deep qualitative research on the culture and lifestyles of the people we're going to try to reach. And we create characters and settings and storylines based on those realities. So to the audience, the local language program, written and acted by country nationals, feels very much about being about a story that is based in that country, and the characters feel very familiar to the audience.
How do you strike a balance between engaging entertainment and imparting the message that you want to get across to the audience?
Roughly 75% of the content is entertainment. And the reason for that is I think none of us go home at night to watch public health messages and or to listen to them. And so we want engaging storylines that people can become emotionally involved in and characters they can become emotionally attached to. And they eavesdrop on the lives of those characters as they're struggling with the various twists and turns of life and learn from them in the process. But for them, it's primarily entertainment. But they're also very much aware that they're learning. And we get lots of letters and text messages thanking us for the learning that they are getting. For example, we got a letter from a woman in southern Ethiopia saying, "Thank you for dealing with the issue of marriage by abduction. Our own daughter was abducted on her way to school at age 14 and ended up married as a result. And we've been afraid to send the 12-year-old girls to school for fear the same thing would happen to them. When your program addressed this issue through the character Wu Balam, our entire village, most of whom were listening to the show, came together and we agreed to enforce the law against marriage by abduction, which we had not known existed, and now it's safe for our 12-year-old girls to..."
I imagine that you must be pretty dependent on local talent, not only to perform the radio dramas, but also to help with the writing. I mean, oftentimes it will certainly be taking place in a language that you yourself don't speak.
Correct. So, yes, we engage 100% in every country local talent. So the country office is run by a country national, and everybody working there and all the writers and actors are country nationals. And what we do is we bring in international trainers who have used the Sabido methodology, and in a few cases we've actually had Miguel Sabido come, and we train the writers in and the producer in the methodology, and then they create settings, characters, and storylines. And we look at summaries of these settings, characters, and storylines, so we have an idea of what's going to happen and what the consequences will be for the negative characters of their behavior. And so we can make sure it adheres to the methodology. But by the time we go through a 3 or 4 week training program with the writing team, they are competent to do this show on their own.
So do you maintain a presence and do ongoing quality control, or have you basically handed off the project to the local talent at that point?
We do maintain a presence, but not with expats. So what we do is we put together in every country an advisory committee of experts on the issues that are going to be addressed. So representatives of the Ministry of Health, representatives of UN agencies and other donors, representatives of NGOs, particularly those that are providing services such as family planning services in the country. And they review every script and give advice to the writers in case the writers get some issue wrong. And they also then are clued into when we're likely to crank up demand for the services, so they're prepared to meet the demand. And, of course, our headquarters program managers also oversee the projects, working with each representative in each country to make sure we understand what's going on in the story, what the various characters' results are going to be for the different behaviors they're adopting. And so we do maintain that level of quality control. But we're not trying to read every script. We leave that to a local committee of experts.
I imagine that one collateral benefit of this activity is that you are possibly giving a boost to or even creating careers for local performers.
Indeed, and for local creative talent beyond performers. So some of the people we have trained in various countries are now working at the national broadcaster, doing programs based on what they've learned from us. So indeed, the methodology is spreading beyond what we ourselves are producing.
So you and I, or if suppose you're giving a talk at a university in the U.S. or Canada or Great Britain, you might talk openly about the problem of, you know, a growing global population. But is that a message that you would incorporate into the types of media that we've been talking about?
Not much. Most people don't base childbearing decisions on global demographic trends, nor even on national demographic trends. So it's not a big motivator to make people experts on population. There are some people, including my wife and myself, who have decided not to have children because of the global situation. But there are many, I would say most people, are looking at much more personal motivations with regard to family size decision making. And so modeling that, such as modeling girls' education, modeling women having the right to work in the workplace outside the home, those are things that are much more likely to motivate smaller family norms than educating people on how many people are being added to the population every day.
When you are putting together a strategy for a local drama that is going to be imparting messages that are going to help people live more effective lives, particularly in certain parts of Africa, you really have to swim upstream against some deliberately propagated misinformation, some of it about AIDS. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, that's very true. For example, I'm told by a UN expert in Nairobi that some of the churches in Nairobi are telling parishioners that condoms contain the HIV virus in the lubricant and therefore advising them not to use condoms. Now, this is, in my opinion, criminal misinformation because they're causing increased risk of their parishioners contracting AIDS. And indeed, there are clearly people who have been persuaded by this misinformation to have unprotected sex rather than using condoms that can protect them from HIV infection. Similarly, there are both intentional and unintentional spreading of rumors about other contraceptives. For example, many people have heard the rumor in East Africa that the IUD somehow migrates up to the heart and stops it from beating, or that various hormonal contraceptive methods cause cancer or cause permanent sterility, none of which is true. And so many people avoid using contraception for fear of health effects. And in fact, that's the number one reason in most countries for non-use of contraceptives by those who are sexually active and do not want a pregnancy. And beyond health effects, various forms of opposition, spousal, religious, and personal opposition, combined with fatalism, that namely the belief that one's deity determines how many children they're going to have and there's nothing they can do about it, another top reason for non-use of contraceptives among those who don't want a pregnancy. Lack of access as a reason for non-use is cited in most countries by less than 1% of the non-users. Most people, and by most, I'm saying 95 to 99% of married men and married women can identify a source of contraception, while in some countries, particularly in West Africa, less than 15% are using any method. So it's the misinformation about safety, it's the cultural factors, namely opposition. Those are the big barriers, and those are issues we address directly in the program so the audience finds out accurate information. There's also another factor, and that is when somebody gets inadequate counseling at a reproductive health service site and, for example, has an IUD inserted and nobody tells them they may experience excess bleeding for a couple of months, and then things will likely return to normal. Somebody goes home and starts experiencing excess bleeding and thinks there's something terribly wrong and has the method withdrawn and then tells 25 friends that the method causes these kinds of problems. So counseling is also critically important. But indeed, what we're doing with our characters, including characters who are health service provider characters, we're providing that information over the mass media so people understand it.
You've mentioned condoms and IUDs. What goes into deciding which birth control method to promote in any given country?
We are primarily focused on the why of family planning, not the what of methods. Certainly, we can have characters discussing different methods and addressing misinformation about them. We do indeed encourage use of long-term methods, such as the IUD and the implant, which is a 3-year implant. The IUD is good for 10 years or more. And Depo Provera, which gives a 3-month protection, because those methods are far more reliable than the daily oral contraceptive pill, because people forget to take it. So we do encourage people to use these longer-term methods, but we're not focusing on method choice so much as getting people to understand what methods are available and go to a service provider and get counseling about their situation, because obviously people have different medical histories and different situations with regard to their sex lives. So it's really important for people to go and get adequate or reliable counseling from a service provider in their community.
Well, we've been talking about showing people or imparting information that would allow people in poor places to live more effectively. But there's another alternative, and that is the heavy-handed, top-down, you know, commandment from a central authority. Say, in China, there was the one-child policy, which was enforced with just draconian brutality in some instances. And also in India, there have been policies of involuntary sterilization. Would you talk about the difference between persuading with narrative versus just a top-down dictatorial approach?
Certainly, and there are, obviously, because of those two examples, there are some people who advocate coercive policies. But imagine a president of the United States announcing how many children people were allowed to have and sending out police to check their menstrual periods, as was done in China. In fact, I've been in villages in China where the menstrual period of each woman in the town was kept on a blackboard in the town center. So, you know, certainly there would be an uproar, and indeed, rightly so. It would lead to probably the collapse of the government, as it did in India when Indira Gandhi allowed her son to impose involuntary sterilization in a campaign that was carried out in the 70s. In China, it's a different story, but the coercion, in my opinion, in China was not only harmful but unnecessary. China mobilized about 1 million people to persuade people around the country about the benefits of small family size, and that was far more important, in my opinion, than the coercion which they held out for those who were not persuaded. But most important, I think, is changing the perception of what is normal so that people feel it's okay to have one or two or even no children and not be shamed by the community because they have a small family. And then people will be much more likely to adopt small family norms. When you think about most of the countries that have achieved replacement level fertility, all of Western Europe, some Asian tigers such as Sri Lanka and Thailand. Thailand's now at a 1.8 child average family size. They've done it voluntarily because they realize the benefits to them, to their economic welfare, to their health, to the welfare of their children, of having small families. And so they're doing it voluntarily. Coercion has actually been used more often for coercive pregnancy than coercive family size limitation. So, for example, the bishop in the Philippines persuaded the mayor of Manila to outlaw the sale of contraceptives. That's now been reversed, but for some time, women were unable to obtain contraception and were having babies they couldn't afford to feed and turning them into orphanages, as we experienced in Ceausescu's Romania back in the 70s. So coercion can go both ways, and coercion is clearly a violation of human rights and much less effective in the long term than people being persuaded personally and motivated personally for the benefits of small family size.
You are listening to SeaRealm Radio. I am your host, KMO. I'm speaking with Bill Ryerson, who is the founder of the Population Media Center right here in Vermont. And we have been talking about basically imparting information via entertainment to people in parts of the world that we used to call the third world. I would like to read a quote from the late Terence McKenna in order to shift the conversation a little bit.
If every person would parent only one child, population would drop 50% in 30 years on the planet. Children in the first world consume between 800 and 1,000 times more resources than children born to women in the third world. Where do we preach population control? You know, we are blind on this issue. You know, the Holocaust was a horrifying incident in the 20th century. And the Germans took an enormous rap for that, as they should have. But fundamentalist Islam, the Catholic Church, have population policies in place which shove more people into disease, degradation, and early death every year than suffered under the Holocaust.
This is an astonishing idea. This is not zero population growth. This is population falling by 50% every 20 years from here on out. So he's commenting on his own suggestion that we just adopt a norm whereby every woman has one child, which would basically cut the population in half with each generation. Terence McKenna continues, if people in the high-tech industrial democracies would limit themselves to one child, almost immediately the destruction of the Earth's ecosystems and resources would halt. We preach population control in the third world, but the statistics show that a woman in the first world who has a child, that child will consume between 800 and 1,000 times more resources in the course of its lifetime than a child born in Bangladesh or some other third world place. And yet, where do we focus on population control? We do it in the third world, you know, what used to be called the third world. So the point is, wouldn't it make more sense if what we're looking to do is reduce the human impact on the natural world to focus on reducing population in countries where we use a lot more resources, places like the United States?
Yes. Of course, as I pointed out, working on reproductive health issues and status of women issues in developing countries is critically important for health and welfare. But in developed countries, you're absolutely right that the per capita output of greenhouse gases, for example, and other waste products is much greater than it is in developing countries. For example, in the United States, where we have one of the highest per capita carbon outputs into the atmosphere, there was a study by two professors at Oregon State University in the statistics department on the carbon legacy impact of family size decisions. And one thing they stated in their report is that each child adds about 9,400 metric tons of carbon dioxide to the carbon legacy of an average female, which is 5.7 times her lifetime emissions. So, indeed, a decision by an American couple to have one less child is a contribution to the climate 5.7 times greater than their own impact on the climate, because of the fact that children are likely to have children of their own over the next several generations, and so the impact goes on for a long period of time. And indeed, on all kinds of consumption, whether it's energy or consuming food that requires farmland to be carved out of wilderness areas, American and Western European consumers are using far more resources than people in poor countries in Africa. So it makes a great deal of sense. And I mentioned we have a show in Hollywood. We have an individual donor who, in fact, encouraged me to get going on doing a TV show for American consumers addressing teen pregnancy. And I went out because the highest teen pregnancy rates in the U.S. are among Hispanics. I went out and met with Nellie Galan, who had been running a network called Telemundo, and asked her advice, and she connected me with a man named Carlos Portugal, UCLA film school grad who has done telenovelas and films in both Spanish and English. And we did some research among Hispanic teens and concluded that we should do an English language show, but with Spanglish mixed into it, about the lives of young Hispanic teens. And I was convinced that this show was going to end up on the PMC website, but we had enough funds to produce 24 episodes of television. So Carlos hired a team of Hispanic writers and actors, and we trained the writers in the methodology, and they produced the 24 episodes and then put it out for network inspection. And it was so well done that eight networks wanted it. We put it on Hulu. It became the longest running program in the history of that network and was in the top five for all 5 years it was on the network, and was the number one show among Latino viewers for all 5 years, and the number one show among all viewers during season two when it addressed domestic violence. But a lot of the story is about the lives of teens at a high school, a fictional high school called East Los High, as in East Los Angeles, where it was filmed. And it's a very well-done show, and now is being sold all over the world, as well as pirated. In fact, I bought a copy of season one at a pirate video shop in Kampala, Uganda. So it's had a big impact, and we're now planning additional shows in the U.S., and we see the importance of addressing consumption behavior as well as family size and teen pregnancy behaviors as critically important in countries like the U.S.
Normally, if a media company is creating media, they're doing it to make money, and piracy is, you know, they see it as taking money out of their pockets. But if you're creating media in order to propagate a message, piracy is good news. That's somebody else voluntarily paying some of your production costs.
Exactly. I was quite pleased to see it. And, you know, for a network that's selling the show overseas, very poor countries are not normally the target. They're looking to sell it to places in Europe and airlines and that type of thing. In fact, you can now see East Los High on Emirates Airlines. So, in fact, the message got out much further than it would have just through commercial sales.
That is good news. I'm personally, I'm not a great big fan of intellectual property law. And to my way of thinking, information wants to be free. I mean, artists definitely should get paid. Creative people should get paid. But the idea that a corporation owns, say, a character like Captain America, you know, when the creator of that character is dead, and that is such a, you know, an iconic character and so symbolic, it seems somewhat perverse to me that the building blocks of our culture are owned by corporations.
Yes. You know, we live in capitalist society, and that is the supreme decision-making tool with regard to most of commerce. But I think what we accomplished with our show, the first show now that we've done in Hollywood, is, number one, we've demonstrated one can have positive messages and positive content and still have a hit show. And number two, we affected a lot of good. We did it with donor support, but in fact, because it became such a big hit, we actually recouped all of the money we spent on it through royalties. So it was a great success story, and that's why we plan to do this again. But getting back to something you commented on with regard to developed versus developing, it's not either or, in my opinion. So the developing world, just on climate change, the developing world puts out more carbon dioxide than the developed world for two reasons. One is a much larger number of people, even though the per capita rates are lower, and the fact that the each person is increasing their carbon footprint as they get wealthier, and so developing countries indeed are developing in many cases, and so it's important to address population issues in the developing world as well, not to mention, as I said earlier, the health and welfare of the people is critically influenced by family-sized decisions. There is strong evidence that every country that's gone from developing to developed status since World War II started with family planning and smaller family norms. And while the income per family hadn't changed, the number of children they were trying to feed, clothe, and house went down in places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, and other countries that were developing at the end of World War II. And so there was a little money left over at the end of the month. And what happened was people put that into the bank. And those savings led to formation of a capital market that made it easier for businesses to borrow and expand. And that built employment, and that drove wages up. And that created the middle class. And people could also put some of their savings into education, which led to higher economic productivity per capita. And all of that combined now is called the demographic dividend. So it's very clear that for a country to get out of dire poverty, it's important for them to reduce fertility rates.
When we're talking about global climate issues, you know, carbon footprints come up, and people in countries like the United States or Western Europe or, say, Japan have pretty high carbon footprints compared to people in developing countries, even if, you know, the developing world is, in aggregate, putting out more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It seems a bit unfair to talk to people in poorer countries who have much less lavish lifestyles than ours, that they need to be cognizant of their carbon output.
Agreed. So, indeed, you know, people in Ethiopia want to increase their quality of life and hence their carbon output. And we are not trying to tell them don't do that, although certainly there are emerging technologies that allow people to improve their quality of life without one-for-one increasing their carbon output. But in terms of total numbers of carbon emitters, there's a very important study by Brian O'Neill at University of Colorado, put out by the National Academy of Sciences, that shows that slowing population growth in developing countries could provide about a quarter of what is necessary to avoid catastrophic climate change by 2050. And it's not 100%, but it's not zero either. And so addressing population as a climate issue in developing countries is important, while at the same time addressing the grotesque carbon output in very wealthy countries is critically important as well.
I was reading about a conference called AI for Good, AI being artificial intelligence, which is a a topic of great interest to me. Did you attend that conference?
I spoke at that conference, and it was a fascinating conference. It was sponsored by over 30 UN agencies, held in Geneva 2 weeks ago, and it looked at how artificial intelligence, which some call machine learning, can be used to improve life. And my role there was to talk about how entertainment media can help people, particularly marginalized people, understand how to utilize artificial intelligence for their own benefit and to avoid some of the pitfalls that come with artificial intelligence. So there are many fronts related to health and economic welfare that use machine learning to help, for example, make better diagnoses and prescriptions than can be done by, say, a rural health extension worker with a high school education in rural Ethiopia. So there are a lot of benefits. There are also, obviously, with any new technology, there are a lot of pitfalls as well.
Well, speaking of entertainment and the power of narrative, if you start talking about the topic of artificial intelligence and the changes that it is likely to wreak on our civilization in the coming decades, and you're talking with people who are non-specialists in the field who get most of their education on the topic of AI from entertainment media, it won't be long before you hear references to The Terminator and Skynet, or possibly HAL 9000 from 2001, A Space Odyssey. These don't seem like particularly helpful touchstones when discussing these issues.
Well, certainly with any new technology, there are a lot of negatives, but imagine that using a global database, a machine could analyze your genetic makeup and look at your health issue and determine, given your genetic makeup and looking at all the data from maybe not everybody, but a large sample of the population around the world with similar makeup and similar disease, the ideal dosage for you for the best chance of recovery. I mean, this is the kind of thing where a machine can calculate this far more quickly than a group of doctors sitting in a room. So just for good. And given the fact that the technology is with us and now being used all over the place, it's important for groups that are interested in helping society improve to know how to use this type of technology for good.
There's a video on YouTube. It's from a channel called Answers with Joe, and in it he's talking about the coming, the revolution in artificial intelligence. And he showed a picture of streets in New York City in 1900, and it was just filled with horse-drawn carriages. And then he showed another picture from 14 years later, 1914. The streets were filled with automobiles.
Yeah,
and there was only one horse in the photo. And that was, a very short period, a very big transition. It had a huge impact on the way people made their livings. And he said that compared to the transition that we're coming up on with artificial intelligence, the transition from horse and buggy to automobile was about like the transition, if you were to switch from drinking Coke to drinking Pepsi.
Yeah, that's right. Among the groups that were at this conference is a group called RoboRace. And they had on display a auto-driven race car, and they're actually planning to have a car race in Las Vegas of self-driven cars later this year. So, these technologies are going to rapidly affect all of us when we get into self-driven cars and when we get into automated medicine of the type I was talking about. And it will be increasingly important for people to understand both how to utilize it and how to avoid the pitfalls.
Well, earlier when I was talking about intellectual property and my distaste for that issue, you mentioned and you emphasized that we live in a capitalist society and that, that is going to shape so much of what is possible for us. But one of the major impacts that artificial intelligence is likely to have in the fairly near term is to erode the opportunities for what Andrew Yang would call normal people to generate economic activity, you know, to find a meaningful and sustaining place within the economy. Is it possible in your vision, do you think, that we are maybe in the later days of our capitalist phase of the development of our global civilization?
You know, I don't know the answer. Certainly, we've seen the same concern with every new technology. Automating car manufacturing put a lot of car workers out of work. And so is that something we should avoid, or is there a way to keep people employed by providing them with training for a new way of working within the current system? You know, one of the programs I'm interested in doing is in the Appalachian region, people who are stuck and believe in the coal industry as the only way they can survive in an industry that is rapidly becoming obsolete because it's more expensive, not to mention environmentally damaging, than renewable energy. And so, indeed, renewable energy are putting, energy sources are putting coal workers out of work. And yet, training them in skills that will make them employable in the new economy is far better than letting them just go on welfare. So I don't know the answer of whether we'll see an end of our capitalist system. I sort of doubt it. I think so far we have seen just disruptions that lead to whole categories of people needing to learn a new way of working.
Well, a difficult way to really look at the problem, it's not difficult, I suppose it's so much as sobering, is that when automobile manufacturing was providing, you know, so many jobs for so many people, the big three automobile manufacturers in the United States created about 1 million jobs. In terms of how much revenue they generate, you know, the tech companies are about as big as the automotive companies were at their height, but, you know, the big three combined, Facebook, Google, and I'm not sure who the other one is.
Amazon.
They employ about a grand total of 50,000 workers between them.
Yeah.
So what automation does is it allows companies to serve much larger customer bases with far fewer employees. And, you know, we assume that when we're in our hopeful modes, we assume that new forms of employment will be created by automation and artificial intelligence, but it seems like a real stretch to say that the new forms of employment will not be automatable.
You may be right, and yet is there a way to stop new technologies from being adopted once they are discovered?
It would seem not. In the lead up to, I think it was World War I, the Russian Tsar tried to get all of the European powers to declare a moratorium on the development of new military technologies because Russia knew that it would be falling behind in that process, and they were quite right. And there was very little hope of that project actually being adopted by the likely winners of that race.
Yes.
So we also have, you know, now the equivalent is artificial intelligence. All the big companies, the big nine as they're called, six here in the U.S., three in China, are racing to develop artificial intelligence because they know that there is a first mover advantage. Whoever deploys the technology first gets such an amazing head start that they really make it difficult for any meaningful competition to rise up. So we are living in very dynamic times. It is, I would say, an exciting time to be alive, but it's a vertiginous time to be alive if you're really paying attention to these technologies.
Yeah, and when you think about the places where Population Media Center is mostly working, the people in very poor countries are likely to be falling further and further behind as these technologies become globally adopted. So it's very important to use media to help people understand how to pursue the education and training they need in order to be employable in the new tech, in the new economy. And at the same time, to use new technologies to their advantage. For example, going back to the technology of contraception, it is one thousandth the cost of other technologies being used to fight climate change. And as I pointed out with Brian O'Neill's study, rapid adoption of family planning around the world could yield 25% of what's necessary to avoid catastrophic climate change. So getting people to understand the reality of that technology, we see as being very important.
Are you familiar with the book Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark?
I'm not.
There's a portion of it that I imagine you would enjoy reading. He has a fictional scenario that he spins out where a small group of programmers in a Silicon Valley company, they break off and form their own company because they have created artificial general intelligence. And what they do to make money with it, at first they just have it solve human intelligence tasks, on Amazon Mechanical Turk, just, to raise a little seed capital. But then they create a media empire because they have the AI that can create photorealistic characters, can write stories, it can, generate human voices that sound authentic, and they can create media in a variety of languages so that, rather than the lips being out of sync if you're watching in Hindi instead of English, the lips are always in sync with the sound of the, digital actors' voices. And they employ, I don't think he mentions the Cybito method in particular, but they're basically using entertainment media to foster workable mindsets in the populations of a huge variety of cultures and countries.
Well, I can imagine that we might benefit from that technology. Just one thing I wanted to mention, the Cybito methodology has yielded amazing results, and I'll just give you two examples because I know we're running tight for time. One is in Sierra Leone, when people coming for family planning services were asked what had motivated their decision, 50% of them named our program by name. And in northern Nigeria, 67% of family planning adopters at 11 clinics that did such monitoring named our program. And then one other example, in Sierra Leone, our listeners were five times as likely as non-listeners to have acquired a bed net for malaria prevention during the 2 years of the broadcast, since we modeled it in the show as non-listeners, and that was after controlling for income, education, place of residence, and religion. So the Cybito method has been highly effective at changing norms on issues like this.
I've been speaking with Bill Ryerson of Population Media Center. The website is populationmedia.org. Bill, before you go, is there any other website or media that you'd like to point folks to?
We are partnered with an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Population Institute, where I actually started my career in the 70s, and I now chair their board, and they work in partnership with PMC. And so populationinstitute.org also has interesting reports on demographic trends and their implications for things like security in West Africa. And you mentioned at the beginning the Post Carbon Institute, of which I'm a fellow. Post Carbon Institute, which looks at climate change, obviously, is also a very interesting organization that your listeners might enjoy looking at their website.
Well, I know many of the podcast listeners are already very familiar with that organization, but we are almost at the top of the hour, and I have a few announcements that I need to share, so we need to wrap it up. But, Bill, it has been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
KML, thank you so much for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back to its back. Old dimensions. Back.
That is the end of my conversation with Bill Ryerson of Population Media Center, and I'm tempted to just wrap up the podcast right here and get it posted, but I'm going to resist that temptation and dig a little bit into the content of this hour. You know I'm a big fan of Terrence McKenna, have been for a long time. I got to see one of his very last public appearances in Seattle, just before, like in my memory, I'm not sure, but in my memory it seems like it was just days before the announcement of his tumor. But that was back in the 20th century. Terrence McKenna has been gone for almost two decades now, and everything that he has to say, while interesting, is increasingly out of date. And that figure, And I read it in a quote, and I played part of it, you know, where he cites it again, that a child born to a woman in the industrialized West will have 800 to 1,000 times the environmental impact of a child born in the, you know, what was then called the Third World. That just seems hard for me to accept. It seems like too vast a disparity. And I'm not really sure, you know, what statistics he was quoting or what measurement those figures reflect. But I just did a little, you know, searching around. After a brief search, I've landed on this paper by the Union of Concerned Scientists, Science for a Healthy Planet and Safer World. And it is comparing CO2 emissions. And these figures are from 2015. And it lists, 20 countries here, according to their total emission rank. And it also gives their per capita carbon dioxide emission from fuel combustion in metric tons. So the country, at least in 2015, that put out the, you know, the most carbon into the atmosphere from fuel combustion was China. Now, Chinese people per capita add 6.59 metric tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through the combustion of fuel. In the United States, that figure is 15.53 metric tons. But in this instance, we're not number one, because in Saudi Arabia, the figure is 16.85 metric tons. Gasoline is cheap in Saudi Arabia, no big surprise there, and they also have a lot of need for air conditioning. But at the very low end of this spectrum of, you know, countries emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from the combustion of fuel, while the United States and Saudi Arabia top the list in terms of individual contributions to carbon, you know, atmospheric carbon dioxide, down at the low end of the range are countries like Indonesia, with a figure of 1.72 metric tons per individual, and India, which is even lower at 1.58. While that is a dramatic difference, 1.58 metric tons compared to, say, 16.85 per individual, you know, that's comparing India to Saudi Arabia, it's not a difference of 800 to 1,000, which is what Terence McKenna was quoting regularly back in the day. So I don't know where he got his figures or exactly what those figures were supposed to be measuring. If you know, please let me know. My email address is kmo@crealm.com. And as you probably know, there is a dash between the C and the R. And if you're ever making any sort of graphic or anything involving crealm.com, both the C and the R are capitalized. So before I go, I will just give you, by total emissions, the top 20 carbon dioxide emitters by country. At the top of the list is China, followed by the United States, India, Russia, Japan, Germany, South Korea, Iran, Canada, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, South Africa, the United Kingdom, Australia, Italy, Turkey, France, and Poland. And as far as I can tell, just at a glance here, there's only one African country on that list, and it is South Africa, which comes in at number 14 with 7.77 metric tons of carbon dioxide emitted per capita. So when we talk about population control and places where population is increasing dramatically, we often think of Africa. But in terms of, you know, who is contributing the most to climate change and to the depletion of resources, Africa doesn't really seem to be that big a player. In fact, a very, very minor player. But I understand that the fear is that, you know, a couple generations from now, when there's a lot more Africans than there are now, they will want to live and consume at the level of places like the United States or China. And that while that would be, in some sense, a catastrophe, we don't really have any moral grounds for saying that they can't live the way we do. Well, my fire alarm just went off, or smoke detector, I guess, just went off very briefly. So I should go and investigate and reassure the cat. So thank you very much for listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I will talk to you again soon. Until that time, please stay well.